Welcome to a new episode of the Focus Podcast. This is your host, Eric Chibi. I am joined today by a special guest. He's an entrepreneur, producer, audio engineer, and CEO of Rich City Studios, Chuck T. Chuck, thank you for joining me today on the Focus Podcast. How you doing today?
Man, I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
Yes, of course. I know that we've been trying to connect, but our schedules obviously have been shifting and, you know, we've been moving back and forth, but I'm so happy we get to connect now. And, you know, we have so much to talk about tonight, but before we do, I always like to check in, you know, knowing everyone is operating in their own world with their own experiences. So give us a look into your world. What's your current mindset right now?
All right, let's go. So yeah, just focused on, you know, making the best moves and best strides for it, man. Getting everything up and running and with these three rooms and making sure, you know, I'm doing everything I need to do. It's just like kind of like a crunch time feeling kind of moment. We're going into a whole new year. There's a whole lot of changes happening. And I just want to be as best prepared as I can be and not find myself saying, oh, I should have did that, you know?
Right. Right, exactly. And just to give a little bit more of insight into exactly your profession, you own a music recording studio in Richmond, California. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. Rich City Studios, located in downtown Richmond, California. It's on Harbor Way and McDonald at 322 Harbor Way. Been there since, I got the lease in the first space, end of 2018, and I opened my doors in January of 2019. So okay. January of next year, it will be 3 years. Wow. First year went really well. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, 2020 came and the pandemic and quarantine and shelter in place and everything. So that was a strange second year of business. You know, it was just very strange for everyone. But after having such a good first year and like really being optimistic and hopeful for how things could progress and all the things to come and then have everything just get shut down, it was like, okay, you know, how do I make the best of this situation and not, you know, be one of those people who's like down in the dumps about it? I wanted to stay optimistic.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And that's something that I've noticed online, that you are definitely making sure that you are consistently being on top of the, you know, sharing content and being progressive about, you know, letting people know what you're doing. And also, when you drive around the Bay Area, through the Bay Area, you'll notice a lot of Rich City Studio banners, you know, which I think have been set up strategically in different areas of the Bay Area. And they're very, you know, they're very clear. You can read them and, you know, great job with that marketing as well, you know, just to let people know that you're out here and what you do, you know.
Yeah, thanks. Because, you know, I didn't want to just be relying on Instagram. Like, and that's like what a lot of people do, Instagram, Facebook promotions. And that's okay. I mean, it helps. But some personally, I just felt like some of those accounts didn't really exist that like I was getting insights from or looks from. And I would look at some of the people and I'm like, I don't know. This just doesn't feel real. Right. So I wanted, you know, when people are really out there driving and really looking at things they see. And when I was in college, I was taught that there's like a rule in marketing where basically people have to see things about 7 times before it really like registers in their brain and they start really checking it out and examining what it is that they're seeing. Yeah. So like just putting one banner out there in one spot is cool, but like you'll glance by and won't ever think much about it. But if you see it here, everywhere I go, I keep seeing that. What exactly does it say? And then you read it. Cause I actually had someone tell me that they lived in Richmond and they would see only one of my signs based on where they would live and how they would travel because they're new to the area. And they didn't read it. They just saw Rich City Studios. And because of where it was sitting, they believed that that location was where I was going to open up the studio, even though the studio was already open. And the banner has my address on there and my phone number and my website. But all they read was Rich City Studios. They were like, yeah, for about 6 months, we thought you were coming soon. I'm like, 6 months? So, you know, it's just like, yeah, I got to, you know, put them out there and keep them out there, because some people that's just so busy in life and just got so much going on that they're maybe not necessarily reading it all the way through. So, of course, but it is catching people's eye, and I, you know, just try to stay, you know, just try to keep my mind going and thinking and brainstorming on ways to market myself and stand out and catch people's attention instead of just relying on one thing.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And we're going to get more into just the business aspects of, you know, and marketing of the business. But before we do, I also want to get, you know, just the backstory as to, you know, what let you down this path of choosing this as your profession, you know, this particular industry, the music. I wouldn't say necessarily the music industry, or would you consider it being the music industry?
I mean, I do a lot of work within it, but I more so say like entertainment industry, because I work with film and, you know, journalism. And so it's I say to people, like, I'm more so like a multimedia specialist, because when I was in college, I mean, well, I'll get into that, like what I studied, when I really tell the backstory. But yeah, it's more multimedia. It's not just music. It's not just film. It's a lot of different things. Audio books, plays, and a whole bunch of different stuff. I mean, if you need to record some audio or edit some video or things like that, 9.5 times out of 10, I can help you.
There you go. Yeah, but, no, that's awesome. That's a great service that a lot of people, and you know, definitely would need now, you know. But yeah, go ahead. Let's go into the backstory. You know, what let you down this choosing this profession in the entertainment industry?
Growing up, you know, I had people who like did stuff at church musically, like court ministers and music and choir directors and things like that. And one of my uncles, he had instruments in his house, like drum sets, organs, piano, and stuff. Even had a piano at my grandmother's house that I would sometimes play on, but never really classically taught or professionally taught or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until elementary school, when they still had music programs in school, that I was actually presented an opportunity to learn how to play an instrument and taught how to read sheet music and stuff like that. So that's like my first real introduction into music, where I started learning how to play clarinet and learn how to read music. And so
at what age?
That was like 8.
Okay.
I believe, somewhere like that. 8. Yeah. And probably 8, 9, and 9, 10 when you, yeah, 4th, 5th grade. So yeah, somewhere in there.
Right.
And then like in middle school, had my godbrother who played drums, teach me a little like the fundamentals and mechanics of playing drums. I never really got too heavy into it, but I understood, you know, the dynamics and, you know, how to play and everything. So that was helpful later on when I started making beats, because I understood like 2-3 and 3-4 and just, you know, counting and the and like 16ths with inside of a measure and stuff, and how all that goes when laying down drums. Right. So definitely helpful. But high school, I took some piano classes, but it was like my 10th grade, my sophomore year in high school. I was trying to play football and I had got hurt. And so I wasn't really playing any sports because I had dislocated my shoulder, and it was like a long process on healing. And somebody came to my school and presented a program. He was like, it's an after-school program, and we let kids, you know, we let the youth run their own radio show. And then in between that, we also teach them how to, like, be journalists and make beats and DJ and things like that. And I was like, oh, okay, I always kind of want to learn how to DJ. This might be something cool. Yes. So I went ahead and got in. They was like, well, you can get paid, too. We give a stipend at the end and all this other stuff. So I was like, oh, okay, I can learn something and get a check. Cool. Let's see what this is about.
Yeah, so, like, win-win, for sure.
Right. So then I got involved in the program, and they, like I said, one of the things was teaching people how to make beats, and another aspect. Yeah, so I was talking about where I was, what was the last thing you remember hearing me say?
Yeah, you were saying that you joined this program, and you obviously could do so many things, like journalistic, music, and then you joined this class on how to, this teaching people how to make beats.
Yeah, they okay. So yeah, they after getting the program and going through it, I was offered a job as a teacher, as a peer teacher for music production. And
Okay.
like during that time, I taught a whole bunch of different people that come from Richmond and everything, like people who have done things for themselves in the industry and gone on to make a name. Like I Am Sue was one of my students back then. P-Lo's older brother, Kuya, he was
Okay.
one of my students. I taught him how to make beats. Another guy by the name of Doc Dollars. He from Richmond, he's from Central Richmond, and like he's making some moves right now. He's like amongst G-Eazy and his camp doing some things. And then yeah, just like a whole few little different people. Like I was there for about 2 years
Wow. Okay. And
teaching.
this program was in Oakland, and what was it called?
No, it was in Berkeley at first.
Berkeley. Okay.
Now it's in Oakland. It's called Youth Radio.
Say that name again.
It's called Youth Radio.
Youth Radio. Okay, got it.
It was
And they're
in,
still operating till this day?
yeah, it was in Berkeley on University Ave back then when I was going through the program. But now it's on 17th and Broadway in Oakland, downtown Oakland.
Wow. Okay. And are you still connected to this day?
I mean, I guess once you're in Youth Radio, you're always kind of a part of the Youth Radio family. It's
Sure.
just like if Youth Radio feels like they can use you at the time because they have such a large group of alumni and people all doing so many things. So like at one point, like when I had first started the studio, I was in a new location. I was in a different location when I first opened up the studio in 2018, and things didn't work out there, and I had to move out of there, and it was like I was on hiatus for a while until I found the place that I'm at now. So during that time when I was on hiatus, I had to, get my money together and stack up. So I had gone back to Youth Radio and worked there for their last little session because they had a staff member like quit mid-program, so they needed somebody to fill in the space, and I just came back and helped out for that last little few months, and then went to start the studio.
Got it, got it. So when you're there and you have people like I Am Sue, who's now a recognized artist across the country, P-Lo, who's having huge success, with his commercial success, and then obviously you mentioned Doc Dollar, who is now on the rise as well and is a Richmond artist. Did you know when you met them, when you saw them record, or when they were making their beats and choosing to go down this path of being a creative, of being an artist, did you see it in them that they were going to be someone of this caliber, of a high caliber, or someone of a high value in, making music?
Well, see, well, as far as P-Lo, I did not teach P-Lo. I taught
Okay.
his older brother, Kuya. Kuya has made beats for Wiz Khalifa and a whole bunch of other people since
Right. That's
then.
my apologies. Yeah, you did
It's
mention
okay.
that. Yes.
It's okay. I just want to make that clear. But actually, when I met I Am Sue at the time, he was already like freestyling and rapping here and there, like just amongst his friends. But he had been making beats for a while. He just didn't know. I taught him how to make beats on another software that like made it maybe a little bit more easier for him to get more beats up, because he was making beats on like a Trident keyboard with the sound card and everything. So that's a lot to move around, and you have limited sounds and things like that. But hold on a second. But yeah, he was already making beats and doing his thing and stuff. So, and even the same for Doc Dollars. Now, I can't really say so much for Kuya, but Kuya and I Am Sue went to high school together. So they were probably hanging out before that and already doing stuff. Or maybe if not before that, then after meeting in the program, they probably started hanging out because, they're all in HBK. They're all friends, they're all business partners. So, but, definitely, like in Doc Dollars, like I said, he was making beats and stuff too. It was just like that process of going from analog to digital. I was there to help them with that transition and teach them. And I mean, we're all pretty cool to this day still. I mean, it's all love because, again, like even though I taught them, we're pretty much all in the same age group, a year or two apart, maybe.
Yeah,
So.
definitely. That's one of the things that makes people really great is being able to learn from your peers and the people around you, and not being closed off into thinking that, you know, you're just too good to learn from somebody because they're around your age group, you know. And it's so cool to see that, you know, even though at that young age, you know, you could take that leadership role and, you know, obviously teach from what you, from the experience you had. And now, you know, you're able to see, you know, what they're doing. And a lot of it, you know, obviously stems from the foundation that you obviously helped set, but they took it to a whole new level just with their own creative genius, you know. So that's really awesome to just see how everything goes full circle. And then from being part of and working with this organization, how did that lead to you getting your own studio? Am I jumping ahead of the story? Because I know you also went to college.
Kind of a little bit of a jump ahead. But I mean, after graduating high school, I got accepted in the Howard University in Washington, D.C. And so I went there and I studied radio, television and film production with a minor in 2D and 3D graphic design. So that's kind of how I like got familiar with all the different softwares to help me, you know, edit film and photography. Like I went through a lot of different softwares and classes when I was there. I learned how to use Maya, which is a 3D modeling software, Lightwave, which is like a CGI animation software that you use, and a whole lot of different things. And, you know, it just made me more familiar on what it takes to get stuff done and like how to do certain things. It was pretty cool. So, but the whole, even while in college, I was still kind of had my entrepreneurial spirit. I guess that's when it really sparked, because I mean, I was trying to sell beats in high school and doing what I could do as much as I could, but you know, I'm a kid, got other priorities. I can't hang out at the studio or do all this other stuff that you could do as an adult, so it was limited. But while in college, once I moved off of the campus, I started a recording studio where I was living at off campus. So I was having some of my peers come by and pay and get studio time, record and just hang out, make some beats, sell some beats, things like that.
Right.
So that was pretty smooth following. And then like while there, I had an internship with Viacom, like doing work for MTV Radio and stuff like that.
And oh, you worked with MTV on MTV Radio.
Yeah. And like after my sophomore year, I had got an internship with Viacom.
Okay.
And so it was nice. I was in New York doing stuff, but things kind of happened in my life that shortened it. So I didn't get to do the internship for as long as I could, but it was a nice experience and I enjoyed it and got what I could out of it.
Right. So, right. Okay.
Later on, I got another internship with like Washington DC Parks and Recreation. Because many of the rec centers in there are two of the rec centers within DC at the time, they had recording studios inside of them. And one of my college professors was over the entire, like that whole aspect of the rec centers. He was over it. He was the supervisor. So I ended up getting a internship with him. And the man was also, he was also the engineer and manager for Raheem Devon at that time. R&B singer.
Yes.
So, you know, I was working with him and getting some insight and advice from him during the time that I was his intern. And that was cool, you know, to work a lot more with youth because, again, I'm at a rec center, so it's kids checking in and doing their thing. And that was cool. So following after college, I moved back out here and worked for like Academy Art University and a few other nonprofits. And they had me in like different high schools like Fremont High and other places like that. And so but during that time I was also recording like when I moved back here, I started recording out of my apartment that I was living at. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was like the breeding ground for some of the things I'm doing now. Like you see me with having flyers out now. That was what I was doing then. It just wasn't as big as the flyers are now. And I didn't have a studio name, but I was at home using my printer, typing up some flyers saying, you need some studio time. Here are the hours. here the
so you would record at your place. You would have people come record at your place. Wow, that's definitely commitment right there.
I post them up to smoke shops, and like I'm like, where do rappers go? They definitely go to the smoke shop. Let me put it up at the
for sure. That's smart marketing, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so I put them up at smoke shops, and people were calling me, and I started getting clients, and things were kind of picking up. And then it was like getting to the point, like one day I get a knock at the door, and I open the door, like, who is this? And he's like, yeah, I heard it was a studio here. And I'm like, homie, like I live here. You cannot just come up to my door. Like, it's kind of a business, but it's not a business like that, homie. You can't, like, I live here. So that was like the wake up call and the sign to say, all right, time to really find a location and do this, because now people are finding out about me and coming here unannounced, unknown, and that can't happen. So I was like, time to do that, time to move. And
yeah, immediately change the locks, get out of here. Yeah.
Right. So I moved back from DC in 2000 and like end of 2013.
Okay.
It was right at the beginning of 2013 is when I came back, because I came back out here and having a studio in my crib. I worked on an album with someone and I produced. It was called Destined for Immortality. It was with an artist named Change. But now people know him as, I believe, Innovator 510. He's a podcast host. He does a lot of interviews with like Bay Area rappers and stuff. I don't know what the name of his podcast is, but I know he goes by The Innovator. It's like Innovator 510. You could probably find him on YouTube, but we did an album together. I produced it and mixed and mastered it. If it was 15 songs, then I'd produce like 10 at the least.
Okay.
You could find it on iTunes. It was like when I was still perfecting my craft as an engineer, so the mixes aren't the best, but I mean, it gets its spins. It does what it does. I mean, it's there. It helps show people like the growth, I guess. They can see like, okay, yeah, he's been getting better with his production and with his engineering, because as you listen to some of the projects I have now, you can hear the growth.
right. Yeah. And I mean, since we're just speaking about producing and you creating, you know, music and a soundtrack almost, right? Because that's what an album is. You said that you help produce at least 10 of these songs. Now, from your experience, do you prefer producing with someone long term, like as in if you're producing and making the music, would you rather create an album, or would you rather just, you know, create hit, like try to aim for hit singles and just sell singles and like beats and stuff like that?
I mean, it really doesn't matter to me as much. I mean, I'm making albums is a little bit more fun. I mean, because you're spending more time in the studio creating, you're bouncing ideas off each other, and you know, you can actually create like a theme or a concept. Because I left it out, but in college, I've worked with a lot of different people. In college, I did an album for this artist who's now signed to Knife Wonder's label, Jamla.
Okay.
Yeah, we went to college together. He goes by Ian Kelly. Well, his name is Ian Kelly, and I guess now he goes by his real name. At the time, he went by Kells. And, you know, we did a whole album together. Now he's running around with Grand National XL in Oakland doing stuff with them, I guess opening it up for them or performing with them. I don't know. We don't associate too much no more. But we did that project and he did his thing. And then I did the project with Change. And, you know, that came out. And let's see. I was wondering somebody else, I think, but I got a couple projects even now on the way. Like I have a project with a group named All Around Players. That project is done. I believe they said the title is going to be one of five, because they're doing a 5 mixtape series in which they team up with producers and get the whole album produced by that producer. So the project that we're doing is going to be the first kicking it all off. And I'm doing the album. Those guys are from Oakland. I'm doing another EP with Richmond artist Vicious V. He owns the clothing line, Real Richmond. You mm-hmm. might have seen people with his shirt. So we're doing a project together, and that's actually both of these projects. All the songs are recorded. All the songs are mixed and mastered and been finalized. It's just, you know, the last little legwork, getting the album covers and everybody getting their schedules together, because, you know, people are adults and have so much going on. It's like kind of difficult, especially even with the all around players, because that's a group. So it's two right. people in that, and then myself. So it's like three people trying to come together. Yeah. It can get hectic. And then I have another project, EP, that's getting worked on with Oakland artist named Monarch V. We got about two EPs in the works. He's got all the beats already. We've already lined up all the beats that are going to be used. So it's just about getting all the lyrics together and getting the songs recorded. But that's coming. So I got a lot of stuff. Like this year, I was saying to somebody, I haven't really dropped any music. And then I was like, I have to take that back, because I've dropped a couple singles with ICB from San Francisco. And, okay. So, you know, some dancing tracks. They're like dancing tracks, some ass shaking, twerking tracks for the party. They cool. Mm-hmm. One's Shake That, and the other is Nasty Bitch.
Okay.
ICB. Yeah, and I produced both of those beats. Okay. And so I did those songs, but like last year during the pandemic and after getting in that accident and everything, I got in a car, like, yeah, let me talk about that. In 2020, for people who might not know, I was driving. Somebody ran a red light, T-boned my car, and I completely shattered my leg, my knee, and I had to get surgery. I was in a wheelchair for about 6 months. Well, I was down for about 6 months, wheelchair for maybe 3 to 4.
You were in a wheelchair for 3 months?
Yeah, for about 3 to 4 months I was in a wheelchair. Wow. And then
what was that healing process like, and what were you doing during that healing process? Cuz I mean, that's a long time, you know, to be out of commission.
Yeah, I that's the worst injury I've ever had. The first time I've ever broken a bone, and I actually broke my knee and I broke a finger on my right hand, and I'm right-handed. So I broke my middle finger. Wow. So it was difficult and obviously painful.
Right.
After getting the surgery, it was just like kind of dealing with the pain meds, because I'm not like a pill popper or anything like that. So dealing with the downers and the muscle relaxers and trying to cope with that, because it was like I was in the midst of working. Like I was on my way back to the studio when the accident happened. Mm-hmm. And so I still kind of had projects. Like I had an album with one artist that I was working with, and I was trying to cope and deal with the pain and everything, and like still being on medication, and things didn't even work out with that one. Like that project kind of fell through because the artist got tired of, they felt like they was waiting on me for too much. And it was like, well, I'm sorry, I was trying to work through the pain, but it was like I couldn't work when I was on the medication. It was very hard to concentrate with that medicine in my system. So I realized I had to like just take a break and chill. Until I no longer needed to take, or until it was no longer so painful that I had to take the painkillers,
right?
Where I could just kind of stomach through it. And so once I got to that point, it was not okay. It was different because I've never been in a situation like that. So it was just kind of like trying to again stay optimistic while dealing with the fact that I'm going to be not working for 6 months and not really having any income. Mm-hmm. To pay my rent and do all the things I need to do for myself. So that was like stressful and had me worry, but you know, thankfully my family and friends and supporters, they came through and helped me out. You know, I did create a GoFundMe and people came out and helped me with the GoFundMe. So I definitely appreciated that, because I didn't really, 6 months is a long time.
Yeah, that's half a year right there. That's, you know, yeah. Can you imagine? Yeah,
I was wounded when I was told 6 months.
So one thing you mentioned is that you obviously were very proactive, and you know, you try to work through the pain. But I think, was it before then or after then that you started releasing merch and different products as well?
That was after. I had already like
put in an order, I think, before the accident, but because of pandemic and shipping and everything and people not being able to be inside their offices, it took my my manufacturers a little longer. But after I had it was kind of like right after I got back to walking, I think that that every once I was able to walk without a cane and crutches, is like I think that my merchandise did come through and I was able to start selling hoodies and t-shirts and things like that.
Got it. And that's going to connect us right to where we left off, which is you getting your studio, right? Because you mentioned that before you had people recording at your home, but can you talk about the process between you choosing and finding the studio that you're at now?
Yeah, that's a story within itself. So I was working for a nonprofit called Alternatives in Action. And during this, at this job, like I had a program where I was teaching kids like music production, basically doing the same thing I'm doing now, teaching kids music production and then recording them. They had a studio at Fremont High School. And so the kids were all focused on trying to be rappers and singers. So the music production ended up going out the window. Like nobody wanted to learn how to make a beat. They just had songs and beats that they got off of YouTube that they just wanted to come in and record. So I was like, well, I'm not going to fight. I got 20 kids in here all saying, let me record a song. Forget making beats. Let's record. Let's do this work.
Right.
So long story short, when I got the job, I did a diagnostic of the computer that we had in the room, and I realized that it was old and out of date and that it wouldn't make it. And I told them, this computer is not going to make it the whole school year. It's going to crash and stop. And about halfway through the year, that's what happened. And when I asked, I was like, okay, well, now the computer's done. I worked with it as long as I could. It won't even cut on anymore. I need another computer. The job didn't really want to give me any money to get, or they didn't want to spend the money to get. So that led to a whole bunch of issues that, long story short, led to me getting fired at the job.
What?
Yeah, it was a whole bunch of shenanigans. But like, the long story short, even on that, the reason that happened is because like people were embezzling. Like if it got found out later and they got in trouble with the law for embezzlement. So nobody just wanted to spend any money because people were putting money in their pockets and they were really doing a disservice to the kids at that place.
Right.
And that's all that was. But like, even before learning of the embezzlement, I knew I was wrongfully terminated. And it was just like, that wasn't the first time in my life that I had lost a job while doing a job well. Mm-hmm. And it's just because of like politics or whatever. So I was just like, I don't really want to do this anymore. Like, I don't want to be working somewhere. And because I'm in California and jobs have the freedom to at will fire you just because somebody wants me to do something that goes against my moral code or just doesn't make any sense. And it's just like, well, that you can just do this and that everything will be right in the world. But you want me to do something crooked. And I'm like, I'm not really with that. Like, and now you want to let me go. It's like, I'm not trying to be insubordinate. But at the same time, it's just like this right is right and wrong is wrong. And I'm not going to be forced to do wrong. And then later you're going to point out that I did wrong when you instructed me to do it. I see right through this plan. You're going to use me as a scapegoat. Like,
exactly. Yeah. Nah, definitely. You got to be aware of certain things like that, you know, especially with working with organizations and corporations. They get a lot of federal funding. So for them, it's an easy write-off. And a lot of times they treat people just like, oh, it's a number, or, you know, we get certain amount of funding because of a body or an individual. So, you know, yeah, a lot, I believe you. And a lot of times that does happen. But continue with the story.
At that point, it was just like, well, I've been recording music. Songs I put out with people have done well and gotten some, you know, recognition. So why not just go all in now on just me? I've been recording people at the house. I'm just gonna focus on that. I'm just gonna open a studio. I was like, I've been in Richmond for a couple of years now since moving back, and there's not really any studios within the immediate city of Richmond. Like you have to go far away or catch a bus, or if you don't have a car, it's nothing like easily accessible to the people. So I said, I'm going to make a studio that's easily accessible to people. That's, you know, where they can get professional work done and affordable. So I went looking for a location, And before finding where I'm at now, I had linked up with my cousin, and we had found, or he had found a location down on like 2nd in Ohio. And so we were going to, he was going to have his gym on one side, and I was going to have my studio on the other side. But things just did not work out. Like, you know, they say don't do business with family and friends. And this was probably one of those instances where it was really, you know, it's really clear. Like, that's something don't do. So things just did not work out between me and my cousin trying to make this happen. And so after that, I had to, I moved my stuff out of that location because it just, it wasn't working out. And then on, even outside of the issues that occurred between me and my cousin, the location was just a bad location. You know, that neighborhood down, I mean, you're from Richmond, you know,
right?
Second,
right.
That neighborhood down there on 2nd in Ohio and that whole little area,
yeah,
has a lot of bad memories. It still has a lot of things going on. And
yeah, when it's a rough neighborhood.
Yeah, it is. And when I first opened up, I was there for maybe about 2 months, 3 months after I got my stuff in there and set up. Yeah. And trying to have people come to the studio was a very difficult task because people were aware of the area and they're like, oh, no, that's a bad neighborhood. I can't come down here. I don't want to come down there.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, it kind of worked. I mean, I don't know. I'm optimistic and positive. I know the kind of crowd I bring and the energy I bring, and I wouldn't let something necessarily as much as like a neighborhood affect the positivity that I was trying to bring. You know, it's like, we're going to shine through that, because at the end of the day, what you bring is what you're going to get. So if you come here with positive and you know, all that good energy and good vibes, and that's what this place is going to become.
Right.
But you know, that didn't work out at that location. So I took, and that's what I had said earlier, I moved my stuff out, and then I needed to recoup and, you know, regroup myself and get my money together again. So I went and got a job at Youth Radio for a few months and helped them out during that time of need where somebody had quit. And after that, found a location over on in the Market Square Mall, and things worked out. I got that, and I was in Suite 20 originally, which was about a 350 square foot room.
I remember that room.
No, that room was like maybe 125 square feet. What am I saying? That room was tiny.
Right.
Know, started there, and then once the room that the suite 22 where I'm at now, once that opened up, I just got in that room and expanded, and that's kind of been the whole mindset, expansion and growth.
No, I feel you. And to get to the destination where you're at now, you know, it definitely took a while, like you mentioned, and you have to go through a lot of experiences. But can you talk a little bit about the history? Maybe you're a little bit more well-versed on the history of the building itself.
Well, let me see. They said it's been there. It was built in about in 1955.
Okay.
I've heard a few different stories. But what I know to be true is that at one point it was like a furniture store, and then when new owners got it, like it was like an open floor space, kind of like with two floors for the furniture store. And when new owners got it, they built the, I guess you would say, the dividers, which made the individual suites that are there today.
Right.
And so that's how it's been maybe since the 60s, or maybe even later than that, maybe the 80s. I'm not sure. Yeah. But what I did find out after, because in 2019, I threw two artist showcases in the building. I threw them in Suite 10, which is about 1,000 square foot suite, and each of the shows had about 100 people come, so it was a good turnout. No drama, no issues, no anything. People got to network and meet new artists, and we had vendors present that were selling their merch, like vendors from all over the Bay, not just in Richmond.
Dope.
So it was a really good turnout, really good event, helped boost the morale of people in the city and everything. It was, I was really happy that,
right,
you know, it was able to take place with no drama, just, you know, just so it could be said and the city can see itself, like, you know, you can come out and have fun and not, you know, it doesn't have to only be something for
45, 50 and over, or, you know, the youth 15 and under. Like, you can throw something for the young adults and not have any drama.
Right. You had your own version of Rolling Loud in Richmond. For real. But what was it? What was the name of the event?
Oh, that was just the Rich City Studios Artist Showcase, part one and part two.
There you go. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of them, the first one, actually, we had received some coverage from Sidewalks TV, which is a nationally aired show. It's filmed, well, the host and everything is located in Richmond. So I reached out to them and told them about the event, asked them to come through and just check it out. And when they came, they brought their cameraman and everything, and they filmed the event and aired it on their show. So in that, then the showcase was in that same episode where it was aired, like, they did an interview with Carmen Electra and a few other people. So it was like, oh, dope. Like, we're side by side with Carmen Electra.
For real.
And like that aired all across the nation. That show is like New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and all over. So, you know, people watching at home, local television, they might have saw a little bit about Rich City Studios and what Richmond in the Bay Area has to offer on up and coming talent.
Nice, man. That's so dope that you're able to connect artists and, you know, talent, you know, people who are in the creative arts and investing into, you know, creating music. So, and now, talk a little bit about now, because now you obviously have a larger space, and you mentioned not only do recording, but you do audiobooks, and also I see that you're now launching a audio engineering apprenticeship, 4-month program. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Starting in January of next year, I have an apprenticeship program. So with this third studio that I'm opening up, or the third room, a part of my, I guess you could say, studio circuit, my studio.
So you're going to have three rooms?
Yes, I'm going to have three rooms. Okay. One room, the main recording room. Yes, the first room, Studio A, is the main recording room. Studio B is my podcast / photography / video / editing room. So in this room, I have green screen set up and I have equipment for running a podcast. And then I also, you know, because of the green screens, if somebody wants to rent it out and do like a photography or do some headshots or something, you can do that. Okay. And then there's a computer in the room. So that way, you know, the photographer or videographer or whoever, if they don't have a laptop or a computer that has enough RAM, or maybe they just want to work right there after they finish filming and shooting, mm-hmm. they can go right over to the computer in the room and start editing and working on what they need to work on. We have a computer available. And people can also rent out this room and use that computer to make beats too, because I have music production software on this computer. So that's Studio B. And then in Studio C, that is another recording room. So people can rent this room out and record all day at a rate of $400 for 10 hours or $250 for 5 hours. And no engineer will be provided, but that's kind of where my apprenticeship program comes in as well.
Mm-hmm.
So with the apprenticeship program, it's a 4-month program in which people will be taught kind of thoroughly on audio technology and being an audio engineer. So I'm going to take people through, you know, the science of sound, because a lot of people don't understand, like, it is a science to it. Like,
exactly.
Sound yes. travels through your ear, and your ears catch it a certain way, and your brain, mm-hmm. you know, registers and takes those frequencies, and what you hear is what you hear. But like, when you really think, it's waves, and it's a lot more complex than just like, oh, I hit this key and makes a noise and that's music. Like, you know, people try to write it off because it's like, you know, music is something. It's people in the world who have just picked up a guitar and never had any training, and they're just the greatest guitar player or whatever. You know, and so because people can do that, some people feel like, I think they look at music and look at it like, oh, you know, it's whatever. And even my field of audio engineering, and it's like, it's not one of those things. It's an actual trade, a skilled trade, and there is science behind it. It's much like being like a carpenter or a doctor, you know, like people think they can go on YouTube, aka YouTube University, and self-teach them, quote unquote, self-teach themselves how to be an audio engineer. And then like, yeah, I know how to mix. And it's like, no, you went on there and asked, how do I mix vocals for singing? And then he showed you how to mix one type of person's voice for one type of song.
Right.
You know, he's not teaching you audio frequency range of the voice and how the human ear hears it and how you can manipulate frequencies to make the ear hear it. They're not talking about all that all the time. Maybe some are, but they're only talking about it for this one subject and not in general. And so like these are things like that I will be covering because it's a science. And whereas people will jump on YouTube and do that, it's like, well, no, it's a real thing and you're really learning this. And so if you think you can do that, does that mean that I can just go on WebMD and become a doctor?
Exactly. Like there's some, there's certain step, certain levels of requirement, steps of requirement, you know, and mastery. Like you have to put in 10,000 hours of practice, you know, but not definitely. This ties in with a post that you posted earlier today on your Rich City Studio pages that said, don't go to a home studio where they have hobbyist equipment but charge you a professional rate.
It's true. I have clients. I had clients come just this past weekend who said they went to somebody's garage to record and they paid them like $40 an hour to do this. And then they had somebody else show up who wasn't making music, just hanging out. And they were like, wait. The song, like when they went and recorded, it's like, he's ready to go. Everything's, we don't have to wait. And they were like, no, this ain't like other dude's spot we went to. This is a for real studio. And so I'm like, you guys paid $40 and he was having hiccups and stuff. I mean, stuff happens. I've had moments where my equipment wasn't acting properly and I had to restart. And it was like maybe 5 or 10 minutes of the session got burnt because I was making sure my stuff was correct.
Right.
So
right.
Like, that can happen. It's technology. It ain't always an A1. Sometimes it's glitchy.
That's so true.
But if it's a common thing, like, you know, every time you go to this man's studio, you're going to have to spend 20 to 30 minutes waiting because of issues. And then he's going to charge you like a professional studio rate. Because, again, I told you I was having people record at my house when before the studio. Right. But I was charging people like $15, $20 an hour.
Wow. That's a very reasonable rate.
Right, because, I mean, again, you're coming to my house. You might be in here one day, and you might say something that I don't like not rap-wise, but you sitting in my house, and you might just, I might notice something about you that I don't really approve of, and it's like, all right, you got to leave my house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want you in my house anymore. I just see you pick your nose and start flicking boogers around my house. Get out. Like, you know, you never know. So it's like, to come to somebody's house is already uncomfortable even before the pandemic. Because you're in somebody else's space and it's no telling, like, they live in an apartment. What if their next door neighbors just make a whole bunch of noise while you're over there trying to record? Now what?
Exactly.
You came over here today, but I'm finna get these songs done. And now you can't even do it right because your whole mood has been blown. And all kinds of stuff. And then, again, like, more important than that is equipment. Like, somebody in the comments are trying to talk to me about how, well, it's about the engineer and it's about the engineer, and I'm explaining to them like, well, I've met people who like are undeniable professionals in this industry. Like, every time they do something, it's like worth six figures, you know. And they get plaques, and every day they only work with the people who we see on TV. They don't even work with unknowns and up and comers. Like, that's, they don't spend any energy doing that. And the first thing out of their mouth when I tell them, oh, I own a recording studio, is always, what kind of equipment do you run? What kind of mic do you have? What kind of monitors do you use? They don't ever ask me about, oh, well, how long have you been an engineer? And they might ask, can we hear some work that you've done? But they don't really want to know about me.
Right.
They want to know about my equipment, because if you've got collectively $800 worth of equipment that you're calling a studio, nobody's really gonna, like, you're not gonna get a great sound, not as great of a sound as somebody who has $3,000, $10,000 mic, a computer with enough RAM to, you know, to efficiently run this session without any glitches, which means this computer single-handedly could cost $3,000 to $4,000.
Right,
maybe more if it's got, you know, depending on how new, a brand new computer with with 64 to 128 gigs of RAM. Yeah. We talking about a Mac? We talking about like $10,000-$12,000 alone on the computer. Mm-hmm. You know, like a brand new iMac Pro. Right.
Yeah.
And so that's just that. And then the mic, like I said, the microphone and the interface, like it's certain things, and people cut corners on these things, and these little corners can tend to affect the overall sound. Like someone, people don't think about it, but like a mic cable, the sound has to travel through that. So if you have a cheap mic cable, just like if you have a cheap aux cord, it's going to sound fuzzy in your car.
Right.
Because it's the same with a mic cable. If you have cheap mic cables, if you cut corners on mic cables, then it could hurt you. Like, and that's the thing. Like me, I got a mic in the booth right now, and it's like worth a few grand. And then the mic cables that's connected to it, they over $100. My mic cables. My mic cables are over $100. Like, I need them, but it sucks when I have to buy them.
Right.
But, like, that's the kind of thing, though. Like, people, like, miss out on when they're putting their studios together. That's the difference maker and like, the overall in-game sound. Because even when I've been stepping my game up and buying newer equipment, I've noticed, and that's what like really made me, because I used to be kind of like, oh, you know, it's more about the engineer and da, 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 da. But you know, as I've gotten older and done more things, I've had so many ways to prove why that's, it's really not, it's the engineer's last. Because if you don't have a good location, because it's noisy or the vibe isn't right, nobody's going to get a good recording. If you don't have good equipment, it's not going to come out right. So regardless of whoever the engineer is, you can't make trash treasure, you know? And so like, that's like the issue with having a hobbyist equipment, because the older equipment that I had, once I upgraded to newer equipment, I was able to notice the sound change.
Right, like exactly.
I had one device that, you know, it had the ghost in the machine, if you ever heard that, where you like hear a hiss for no reason, or like hear like a sound, and like your mic level shows that you're picking up a sound even though nobody's making any noise. And right, there's no air in the room. That's the ghost in the machine. And one of my devices had that.
Mm.
And then once I upgraded and got rid of that, I was like, oh, that hiss is gone. Oh, so the whole time it was that. Right. Like,
bad effect.
Yeah. Yeah. Really? Like quiet as a cat. It all did. But like, when you're recording four songs in a day and all of them have it, you don't notice it. But once it's gone, then you notice it's gone. It's like, dang.
Exactly.
And like, that had nothing to do, like, no matter what I would do as an engineer, it's going to be in there because it's recorded in there.
Yeah.
And it's only so much you could take out, but it's in there, and that's all because of equipment. And just like, even with and then sometimes it's not even about being cheap, it's about just being a professional and knowing your equipment. Because with microphones, certain microphones pick up different frequencies than others. So it's like, this microphone will work great for a Barry White voice, but this microphone over here works better with an L. DeBarge type of singer.
Okay.
Just because of how it picks up on certain frequencies. But people are just looking at it and they're like, oh, I was watching a YouTube video. I seen such and such in the studio and he had a mic, this mic. So I want to get this mic.
Right.
And it's like, but this mic might not even work well for all of your clientele. You need a mic that's kind of universal, maybe, into like, you know, and that's the thing. But people they aren't necessarily students of the game, because people feel like they could just pick it up. And like, I've had a lot of conversations with people, like, they're like, oh, I'm self-taught. And it's like, all right, well, when you self-teach, when and where does the lesson begin and end?
That's a great point. Very great point. So I was listening to an interview with Russ, who's a rapper. And obviously, I'm pretty sure you're familiar with him. And he was mentioning, or this clip went viral, and he was talking about how an artist, I don't know if he was, you know, speaking towards newer artists or just any artist in particular, but what he was saying was that he, for $3,000, roughly $3,000, he bought all the equipment for his studio, right? Mm-hmm. That's what he says, right? Mm-hmm. To make a few songs that eventually, you know, he went platinum, you know. But the songs that he wrote and he produced them or whatnot. But what he was trying to get at was that artists should not, this is what his wording was, right? Waste money at studios, and they should learn how to do everything themselves. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, his situation may be a little bit more different. Mm-hmm. And like, because like one thing he hates to acknowledge, and it's just like weird, is like race plays a huge factor in his career, I believe.
Very
like,
true.
You know, like white mm-hmm. artists get different contracts than artists of color.
That's true.
Just like with loans and things like that. And mm-hmm. so, and they get different opportunity. Like I've seen an interview with Russ where he talked about from that one little short time when he was signed to the label, how the people over the label introduced him to everybody who's a mover and shaker within the industry. And mm-hmm. so now he was able to not sign another deal and just take his money and spend it directly with the people who could put you in position in the industry. But it's like, okay, what made him so special to meet those people? Because these same people who he was signed to had other people signed to that they could introduce. And you can't make me believe that he's the only smart business person in the entire industry. Like he's the only person that said, oh, let me keep this person's contact number so that way when I'm out of this deal, I can just call them directly. Right. So, you know, certain opportunities I feel are presented to him, and like it can make sense. It mm-hmm. just depends on your goals, because him, he was looking for a deal. So, right. So it's like, okay, I'm gonna sit at home and record these songs mm-hmm. to basically what are the equivalent of a demo. And then when they pick them up, they're gonna pay for me to go to a professional studio and record it. So, which this is why you might not need to pay for, because the label will pay for these things.
Right.
Checks from doing shows, then he's like, now I can upgrade from my $3,000 equipment to official equipment. I can buy a house and put a studio in my house, and then the game changes. And then so then you put this not so true narrative out there that like, oh well, you don't need to do that, and you know, like where you basically saying you could kind of lowball it until you get on. But that's not necessarily true for everybody. And it's like sometimes you need to go to the studio, because the difference for Russ and the average artist is Russ was making beats before he started rapping and doing all this stuff. So he was kind of a student of the game, knowing what equipment does what and how to manipulate these devices to do what he wants to do. But yeah. Somebody who's just focused on, I want to be a rapper, I want to be mm-hmm. a singer, they might not know all that there is to know about sound. And then they go to the store and they're like, let me buy some mic cables, like I just said. And then they buy the cheap mic cables.
Yeah.
So it's like those type of things are the little details could be what hurts you in trying mm-hmm. to do it yourself if you don't know what you're doing. Like I could go to look on YouTube right now or buy a book that tells me how to build stuff and mm-hmm. go buy some wood and hammers and nails and try to build me a coffee table.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean when I build it, it's going to be the best looking coffee table. And you kind of already know off top, it's not going to be like the coffee table you would go and buy out of stores. It's going to look like arts and crafts.
Exactly. And
like it's kind of the same thing. Like, so I don't, you know, that's his opinion and how mm-hmm. he feels for artists and what they should and should not do. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily agree. I think people should do what works best for them. Because like I write songs, so let's say I write a song that becomes a hit and it's like, yeah, he had his own studio, so he didn't need to go to no studio, so nobody needs to go to a studio. And it's like, hey, it could be said that, but that's not necessarily, you know, it's like
right.
Yeah, it's like, so yeah, like, you know. And then like at the same time, like I don't know if Russ was recording other people at his crib during this time before the fame, but mm-hmm. if he was, well then he's getting money right there to help fund the operation even more. So why are you saying you don't need a studio? You was using the studio having other people come in order to fund, you know. So it's like,
yeah,
it's kind of hard to call and say, but I think people just got to do what works. Like if you know how to engineer yourself and to get what you want to sound like, because that's the other thing, some people start studios and only because they want to help themselves and not necessarily record other people. So it's like, if that's all you're doing at the house and perfecting your sound for yourself and that's what you want to do, okay, it might take you a little bit longer than some, because you can go and spend money with somebody, an engineer that knows exactly what to do, and he'll get your song right today. Yeah. And then you can have this song out by the end of the week instead of spending 2 weeks to a month
looking up videos and figuring it out. But some people, they get pleasure out of that. Some people, they just don't like to spend money, so they get pleasure out of being able to get the final product with, like, yeah, I never spent anything.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, it's just like, what are you in it for? What are your goals? Because I have a client who believes that, even though, like he said, like, even though it might not be the best sounding stuff, like, meaning, like, because he, like, tries to mix and master himself sometimes. He's like, I think people will be able to hear, you know, I think an A&R or somebody from the label will be able to hear and see my talent through that and still want to rock with me. And I'm like, homie, that's not how the industry works now. Like, there, nobody buys albums anymore like that. Like, it's all streaming. So before a record label goes and signs you to a contract and spends millions of dollars in promotion, they want to know that you can at least get the, like, you can get a finished product and you can sell it. So if you're making bad music that doesn't sound as good as perfect, like, it isn't put together properly, less people are going to listen to it. And that's a double whammy and a negative side for your career. And I was like, we in a whole new world in space now. So it's like, you can't just, like, back in the day, you could have some crummy demo in the A&R here, and it's like, oh no, this is cool, we're gonna bring you in the studio and we're gonna have our producers fix this beat and we're gonna, you know, that's different. But now home studios, if you got the money, especially if you go hop on the song, like most people do, talking about all the money you got, it's like, so you can spend a couple grand in to get your studio right and make this sound better. Are you couldn't spend a couple hundred dollars to go to a studio and just pay an engineer to make it sound good?
There you go.
So it makes the industry kind of look at you maybe a little funny, but you know, I can't speak for every A&R and every label. They might think, well, regardless of that, you got the look and, you know, this, that, and the third, so we'll do it.
Well, let's also talk about the other sides of, you know, the music business, because, you know, you don't necessarily just to be have to be the artist or the face. You could also, you mentioned it, you could be a songwriter. Can you talk a little bit about the difference about between being a songwriter? I've heard a lot of, you know, stories and watched a lot of interviews from people who people wouldn't know who these people are, what they look like. They don't even know their names, but they wrote most of the songs that they listen to, you know, and they're behind the scenes. So,
I mean, songwriting isn't even always a behind, like, it's just about who you know and the right people and getting stuff in the right hands. Maybe get a manager or something behind you if that's what you want to do. You just have to, like, I have people who write, I have some artists who write very good songs, and I'll say to them, like, have you ever thought about maybe trying to sell these songs? And because it's art and people take things so personal, they're like, oh no, I would never sell my songs. I'd rather just sing them myself, because I feel like selling the song means that you're accepting that you can't make it in the industry, so you got to sell it off to somebody else to make it. And I was like, whoa.
What? That's somebody's perspective? Somebody told you that? Wow.
Yeah, somebody told me that straight up. It was like, I feel like selling a song just means that you've accepted that you can't make it in the industry, so you're selling it so you could just try to get something because you can't sing. And I was just like, whoa. If that's how you feel, like, that's how you feel, I'm not, that's how you feel.
That's interesting.
So, you know, and I can believe that that might be a lot of people's you know, perspective, perhaps. Some people, they don't want, they don't have a problem with selling their songs, but they don't want anything changed. That could be an issue. And I mean, but you know, it's about, I feel like selling songs is just about knowing the right people or having somebody I could vouch for. Like, sometimes you do need to record those demos just so people can hear it, but sometimes the issue might be somebody writes a good song, but they don't perform it the best. So then when they try to record it, it doesn't necessarily come out good, and the artist can't hear the potential because they're too busy caught up on listening on how bad it sounds.
Right.
But you've got instances in the industry where artists like Sway Lee from Ray Shremmert,
right?
He wrote Formation for Beyonce.
Okay.
And then Future wrote Drunken Love for Beyonce. And then you got, like, Party Next Door wrote Work for Rihanna. So, like, you know, and even, like, remember These Hoes Ain't Loyal by Chris Brown. You look up the writer's credits for that, you'll see Mr. Fab and P. Diddy are writers on that song.
Mr. Fab from Oakland.
Mr. Fab. Okay. Yeah, Mr. Fab is a writer on that song. He, I remember he had mentioned it to me once when I was talking to him at, like, an end of a function. And I was like, really? And I had I really went home and looked that one up. I was like, he's what?
Yeah.
Where and how? I was like, it's Chris Brown, Lil Wayne, and Tyga. I was like, who'd he write for? Chris Brown? Was it the I Got a Chick in the Bay line? I was like, which line?
Yeah.
Nah, I was like, okay. But you know, it'd be like, but when you look at that song in particular, it's like 20 writers or something. There's hella people that wrote on that song. They got writer's credit. So
there's
a lot of roles and a lot of positions within the industry, and like not necessarily being a talent out front, you can do a lot of different things. And I have another course that I teach, a music fundamentals class, like music industry fundamentals. So this class I teach is more on teaching an independent artist how to manage their independent career, like what are, like basically teaching them what are royalties and how do I go about securing them for myself? How do I copyright music? How do I register stuff on ASCAP or BMI, depending on which one I use? And then like at the end of the course, I wrap it up with different positions within the industry and what they are, what do you do in those positions, because people hear terms like A&R and producer and executive producer and all these other things and don't really have a clear understanding as what it is and what they do. So like I'll at the end of the course I go through that just so people can know, because everybody doesn't necessarily want to be the talent
exactly,
but having the knowledge that for example, like in that class, like I said, I teach you how to copyright. I'm going to teach you the process of copywriting your song. And like copywriter is a job within the industry because it's such a tedious task, especially when somebody's like releasing an album, or if you got three or four people releasing an album on the label at the same time. For, having somebody designated to do that is helpful, because currently for myself, for like registering songs on my ASCAP, or Sound Exchange, or for copyrights, I have to do all that myself, and that could be a long process. Like that, doing just one of those, depending on how many songs are on the album, could take an hour or a few hours. Especially if I'm got a lot of information to put in, like it's a lot of people on this song, and I have to get everybody's name and give them all the proper percentages. All that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a lot of jobs within the industry. It takes a lot to keep it going and a lot of knowledge to retain, to know what to do. It's not a simple task, but it's rewarding.
What team do you think an artist needs? Let's say an independent artist, who should they have on their team? Should their team consist of? Should they have a manager? Do they need a manager? Do they need a stylist? Should an independent artist be focused on stylist? Like, what should be their focus?
It kind of depends on person to person, because if you're an independent artist who has a big budget, or like independent in the sense that you're not signed to a major, but like you've got a benefactor.
Right. Or a sponsor.
Yes, a benefactor or a sponsor over your career, and they have a budget that can allow you to do certain things, then you might want to have these certain things. Because, there are certain artists who I've seen who are up and coming, and they're trying to, I think, create a image for themselves, like as far as style goes. And it's like, well, if that's what you're going to try to do, then maybe you should get a stylist, because you look crazy.
Look, I saw a picture of an old school Drake. He was crazy. I was like, yo, this was when he was popping too. When he had just first came out, when he was doing the Trey Songz collab. But eventually he got it together and cleaned it up. Now the ladies love him. Like, he's cool.
So yeah, like a stylist, I don't know. That's like, that has nothing to do with the final product. But now in this age of like where you could be famous before you actually have any good material, maybe that's the angle that person is trying to be. Maybe they want to be Boonk Gang and be more famous on the internet than they actually are for their music. Right. So, like, it's hard to call on that, but You know, I don't. It's kind of hard to call because it's like I could say, well, yeah, you want if you can, you want to get you a videographer, but do you want all your videos to be the same?
No.
So okay, maybe you need like a photographer though. That's helpful. If you got somebody in your family that or a friend that really just doesn't mind holding the phone and videotaping everything you do just to get another angle other than you holding the phone directly on yourself, that can help.
Right.
Like some type of a street team. But you don't necessarily need a street team if you got enough people within your group helping you do stuff. It's just like everybody take a flyer and go put them somewhere. Take a stack of flyers and go put them somewhere. Like, you could do that. So, I don't know. Maybe like a graphic designer, just so you don't have to go outside of the group every time you want an album cover or want something done to a photo that you took. Just to hurry up and get it done. That could be helpful. You know, a producer maybe, but I don't know. That could get hectic too, because if you're not paying them, how are you paying them? You know, like they're over here feeding, like, because you can say, okay, we together in this producer rapper and we're going to do this together, like Eric B and them and everybody else in the game. But at the end of the day, you're asking the producer to feed into your dreams and sacrifice a lot of stuff that they're doing, because they could be taking these beats and trying to find some artists who are willing to pay, but they're sacrificing and giving you beats for free perhaps. And you guys are creating these songs hoping that one day they'll pop. But like what a lot of producers sometimes might not realize or know is that, yeah, the songs might pop and the artists might be going to do shows and stuff like that, but the money that the shows are giving are going straight into that artist's hand. They're not, so it's on the artist to split it with the producer. And if, you know, and that's where things could get crazy. That's where it could get ugly, because it's like, man, you just got $2,000 for this show tonight. You never pay me for none of these beats. And now we getting some money. So what's up? Give me half of that. And right. then it's like, give you half? Somebody could be like that, like, you know?
And so talk about that in the music business. Like, when should people be, like, if you're just an up-and-coming artist, because, you know, there's so many, we hear the stories of artists and their contracts and the horror stories, you know, when should artists start taking their music seriously? From the beginning, what's the process?
That again depends on the person, because you might be just like, oh, I'm just making a joke. But if you're really trying to be serious, you need to be serious from the beginning. Right out the gate, you need to learn the industry. You need to learn the business, because like there was a time when, yeah, when I was in, like I said, Youth Radio. It was all like, you know, fun. But then it was like, okay, this is really what I'm doing. So like, how do I make sure that I'm not taking in these artists of the past? Like, how is money made in the industry, and how do I secure it for myself without having to let somebody else count my money and then give me a piece of it? Like, I want to know how much I'm making, and you know, so like figuring out these questions and everything is how you don't sign a bad deal. Like, because I've had opportunities to sign with like major people and major groups and stuff in the past, but the like when the contract came and I read the contract, I was just like, this doesn't seem like a good idea. And then, or like when we had negotiations, I was like, well, what you're offering me really doesn't make any sense. It seems like you just want me to, it's like you're hoping that I jump on this because of the fame and clout that you have, but that's not going to do anything for me financially. Like, I'm going to be still wondering what's up with paying bills perhaps. And you know, like, I'm not, it almost feels like I'm going to get pimped if I join up with this, and I'm not trying to get pimped. I don't have a problem with signing a deal and working with somebody or even working for somebody for a minute, but I don't see any real revenue coming in from what this paperwork says. But that was only because I knew how to read a contract and what to look out for.
Right.
You know, I had educated myself enough to where I'm not so lost. And that actually even happened in art, like, an artist/friend recently, he sent me a contract And I read it, and I guess he was under the impression I didn't have any knowledge in the music industry. And when I call, when I asked him about, well, why do these things say differently based off of what we actually negotiated work when we spoke, then he wanted to tell me that things that I knew were fact as far as how the industry goes and what these words mean didn't mean what I knew them to mean. And I'm like, no, I'm like, for example, like one, he had, it was a phrase slid on the contract, work for hire. And I'm like, these were not works for hire. Like, you did not, you did not come to me and say, hey, I want to give you some money to make these type of beats and think these were things I had done. And then you just got on them, but like, they're not work for hire. It's like, so why should I lose any of my copyright? Like, why should I lose any rights to something that I already had done that, you know, we decided to do a full song together, but the beat was already done. You just created lyrics to this, and now all of a sudden I'm supposed to lose everything.
Right.
And like, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's like being educated on copyright laws and legal terms when dealing with this and just what goes on in the industry. You need to know, or else somebody can and will, with the opportunity arises, they will play you and have you badly. I just saw something online talking about Summer Walker's deal and how bad it is, and like she doesn't have any control over masters or anything. But you know, I think a lot of hype is put on masters because of like movies like Ray Charles and things like that. But I tell people all the time, like, people are so concerned, like, it's a lot of artists, oh, I control all my masters, they'll say that quick. But they don't control their publishing, and masters are only important if you're somebody like Adele, Future, Miley Cyrus, somebody who gets their songs featured on commercials and in movies. Then then that's when it becomes important, because they need to get the okay from the master rights owners in order for these songs. But when we're talking about radio airplay and YouTube and Spotify and all of these things, that's publishing rights.
Okay.
So like, people will be in publishing deals in which they're getting like 64, it's a 60-40 split, and they're getting 60 and the label's getting 40. And that's a hard deal right there. Like, you're splitting and you're splitting everything, and then they're like, well, I control all my masters, but then you'll never hear any of their songs anywhere outside of when you select it.
Right.
So it's like, you got control of something, but you don't know how to, like, because usually when people give up their masters, like the artists I named before, these artists are in deals where they don't even, they might not even really control any of their masters, and they might control a small percentage. They might be in a 360 deal, like Future was in a 360 deal. And so when you're in those kind of deals, the label will do things to get your music out there because they're getting money back. It's an investment. It's worth them spending the time and energy. But when they're not getting it, they're going to work with the artists that they have that advantage with. So like, that's the, like, so the reason, like, somebody, when you watch Ray and Ray Charles is at the table and he's like, well, I want my masters, because you got to think, Hit the Road, Jack, and all these songs that Ray Charles came out with during this time.
Classics
that get played because they fit moods and times and all this other stuff. He got a Georgia on my mind. Like, so anytime somebody is in Georgia and they want, that's what they playing. And he, you know, so somebody like him, that's very important. And Aretha Franklin, like, you know, that's something, yeah, you want to have those masters. That's why when somebody dies, the conversation of masters always comes up, because it's like, oh, DMX just died. So now, oh, well, to remember him, we're going to put his music in movies and try to put it wherever we can. Well, who is this money going to? So like, these become the conversations.
Yeah. Man, this conversation needs to continue, and we have so much more to talk about, because we're just barely, you know, hitting at the surface, but we're getting close to, you know, our to our time limit today, simply because, you know, we don't want to pass you know, the time limit. But yeah, but man, there's so much more to talk about. But before, just to close out, you know, before we get out of here, you know, you've already, during this conversation, you've been dropping so many gems, you know, for artists, you know, whether you know, whatever they are, wherever they find themselves in their career, you know, whether they're just starting or they're established, you know, you're giving a lot of great, you know, gems. But what would be something, you know, to leave the audience with, you know, someone who is a creative, someone who is creating art, you know, what advice would you give to them, you know, as someone who is an audio engineer, but also owner of a recording studio? What advice would you give to them?
I mean, if you're an artist out there and you're really trying to like reach the masses with your music, I think some advice I could give is think about the world, think about the group, the whole, like people come into my studio sometimes and have really good beats and sometimes even really good hooks. But then when they get to their verses, they're so personal that it's like, you know, I'm right here with you recording this and like, I can't relate to it, but I was all in when I heard the hook, but you lost me with the verse because you got so personal. It's like, I'm sitting back learning about you, but it's like, I didn't really come here for that. Like, I wanted to just enjoy myself and like, or hear a song that captures a mood and a vibe. So, you know, a brother I've been working with lately, now he's not an artist, he owns a label. And one thing like he always says is like, we're trying to create records. And it's like, yeah, we're not necessarily trying to create songs, we're trying to create records. And if artists can understand that little bit, then yeah. And some people are like, well, what's a record? What's the difference between a record and a song? You mean like a vinyl, like a CD? Like, and it's like, you know, I think that might have a little bit of a different meaning depending on each person. But I think universally and overall, the statement is being made to say, like, make something that's like relatable, lack of a better word. Like, think of every hit song you've ever heard that's taken over the club or taken over the world. Like, why was that song able to take over like that? Because it captured a mood, a thought, a vibe, a feeling that everybody could get behind. Like, look at that Little Baby song that he got about what is it called, Bigger Picture. Everybody talked about that song, like, and it's like, honestly, we've all heard better song, better quote unquote conscious songs talking about what's going on in time than that. But he dropped that song at a time where a lot of stuff was going on based off the George Floyd trials and everything happening within that. And then, like, he didn't necessarily make a song that was like kind of captured the African American's perspective. I don't feel like he spoke on it, but I feel like he kept it really PG and universal. Like we're all in this together. Unity was kind of like how I felt his verses came with it. And it wasn't really like, you know, from a standpoint of like, man, we get people of color get discriminated against. It has to stop. It was like, oh guys, we're all in here together. Look at the bigger picture.
Right.
And that's why that song was able to catch, because all of his Caucasian fans were able to not feel attacked. Because, you know, sometimes when speaking on injustices based off of race, you can't have a conversation with some Caucasian people because they start feeling attacked. They start having what I've heard some people refer to as white guilt.
Right.
And it's like, so, and when they get to that point, they shut down and close up and you can't even have a conversation with them anymore. And it's like, I'm not even talking about you.
Right.
Like, I'm not, you don't necessarily do this, but this is an issue that I don't want to hear that because I don't see color.
Yeah.
So, but like having that knowledge, he was able to create a song that everybody kind of gravitated to. And, you know, I feel like right now it's escaping me, but just look at any other time somebody makes a conscious type of song speaking on society,
right?
It ends up becoming a line drawn in the sand, and then you have one side of America talking about, yeah, that's right, and another side of America talking about, oh, you're victimizing yourself, and da 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 da. But and it's like, well, why is that? What makes this song different is because he took the perspective of, we're all good people, and I don't see color myself.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's marketing, it's music, it's a business. Mm-hmm. And I think some people get so caught up with the art side. It's like, okay, you could be at home and make songs that's personal to you and help you feel better. That's therapy. It's all good. But if you're going to release this to the masses, you got to keep that in mind. It's like, what do people want to see? What do they gravitate to? What do they relate to? So as an artist, independent artist making music, and as a fellow creative myself, I say just, you know, be a little bit aware and where you want this to go and how you want it to land when writing your lyrics and putting your song together.
There you go. There you have it. You know, very well said from a not only audio engineer, but a professional in what is the multimedia, you know, universe. Charles, Chuck, you offer so many great, services, and I want people to be able to connect with you and contact you after this interview. So how can they reach you?
Social media, it's Rich City Studios with an S at the end, so it's plural, RichCityStudios. So add Rich City Studios on any social media, URL/Rich City Studios. Mm-hmm. So that's Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Also have a website, RichCityStudios.com. And you can email me as well, RichCityStudios@gmail.com.
Yes. And then you also mentioned some of the programs that you have coming up that will be available. People can look into those. Where can people find more details about those as well?
I have a Patreon page where you can sign up, and it has the details on those classes, because I spoke about the apprenticeship class, but I also offer a 1-month music production class in which students would meet once a week. For 4 weeks, obviously it's 1 month, and we'd go over, you know, introducing them to the software. I have a beginner, intermediate, and advanced class, and they're 3 hours. Each class is 3 hours, and on top of being there for the 3 hours, students get 6 hours during the week outside of that to come to Studio B and work on music production. As like with the apprentice program, students will get 12 hours a month to come to Studio C and work on I give assignments with the apprentice program and things like that to help, you know, help them learn better and just get some practice in. And right, so they would get some assignments and have 12 hours a month to come into the studio to reserve some time and come in the studio and work on their assignments and any other projects that they might want to work on and just hone their skills. Mm-hmm. So you can find out about those two programs on I have a Patreon. So it's patreon.com/richcitystudios. And you can go on there and go through the tiers and read up on them. I have apprenticeship. My apprenticeship is 4 months starting in January. So that one's going from January to April. Then I have another one from May to August, and then September to December. And so you can sign up for either one of those. Since the one starts in January, you can sign up now on like a payment plan. And the one for January to be $400, for November, $400 for December, and you'll be paid up for the first month. Each month is $800, or you can pay a one-time payment of $3,000 to cover your 4 months of the program. So I gave the payment plan options just to give people a way to secure their spot and start making, you know, payments, so that way they're not necessarily like scrambling to try to get the money together. They get a little bit of a head start. And for the other programs, for the session starting in May and the one starting in September, you also have payment plans available for that, where you can secure your spot. And those start at $200 a month to give you more time to stack your money up. And by the time the class starts, whatever the remaining amount is will be split evenly amongst the 4 months for you to make those payments.
Wow. Man, you are offering a whole gang of creative services, man. So if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a creative, if you're someone who's looking to express themselves artistically, and you want to do that here in the Bay Area, you have a creative hub that is available to you through Rich City Studios and Chuck T. Go ahead and contact them directly through the information that he just shared with us. And you know, before we get offline and disconnect, I want to say thank you again for coming on the Focus Podcast, Chuck. and sharing, you know, some of your wisdom, your experience. And just to wrap everything up, I saw a picture that you were on Instagram with Too Short. What was that conversation like, man? What's Too Short talking about?
Oh, he was doing a fundraiser for a scholarship program for the youth. So I went by there and bought a t-shirt to help add to the pot, you know, and, you know, just introduced myself. I'm from Oakland, grew up on Too Short. You know, one of my favorite rappers. So that was cool to finally actually meet the brother face to face and introduce myself, told him what I do. I own the recording studio. He was like, man, you know, I've seen those banners all around.
Hey, that's so dope.
Right. So, and I told him, you know, if he got any, because I know, you know, he's super established, like been doing it before I was even a thought. So I'm not silly enough to run up on Too Short, like, yeah, Too Short, if you need a studio, like Too Short got his own studio. Like,
right.
But I did let him know, like, if you have any artists, because I know he works with a lot of young artists and people coming up from all of LA and back and forth, you know, he's been all over. Like, if they ever need a spot, man, you know, Rich City Studios, have them check me out. And he introduced me to some of his younger artists that he actually had there with him. And they said the same thing. Like, yeah, I just seen your sign. You know, every time I get off the freeway, I see your sign, man. So, it's always good to just make that connection, name, put a face to what they seeing. And, you know, now they know I'm a real person, because I've had people call and say, you know, I wasn't even sure if this was real. I had to check, because like somebody told me, like, they know some people in Richmond who be running scams, and they thought I was one of them. Man. And they was like, man, I know them brothers and how they do. I had to check and make sure it was real and y'all wasn't hustling.
Right. Nah, man. Nah, that's super dope, man. It's great to hear that, you know, you were able to connect with the legend, you know, and you were obviously, you know, supporting his movement, whatever he was doing, you know, with the youth. And, you know, so great to hear everything that you're doing and that you've done with the youth in the past. You know, I know that, you know, you're going to continue all that great work in the future as well. But like I said, we'll continue this conversation on a later date. This was just an introduction to, you know, so much more that, you know, you have going on. But Chuck, thank you so much for tuning in tonight and, you know, speaking with us here at the Focus Podcast. We'll be talking offline and continuing our conversation. But anything else you want to say to the audience before we wrap it up?
Yeah, nah, man. Thanks for having me. You know, everybody, thanks. If you got any questions, you know, you hit those links. Check me out. I got music on iTunes and all that, too. Chuck T, Chuckt, all one letter. I mean, all one word, capital T at the end. If anybody out there, I also make, I have an album, Sleep Music Sounds, for anybody out there and maybe for meditation or having sleep issues and they need like some white noise sounds to help them calm down and relax at night, check that out, because that's actually something during my time when I was injured. I was having a hard time sleeping, so that kind of made me want to make that so I could listen to something to help me relax a little bit better. And I mean, it helps me, and I've seen, like, through my streams and whatnot, some people across the world are listening to this album every night, so it's helping some people, so maybe it could help you.
There you go, man. That's such a wonderful thing. Right on. Thanks again, Chuck. Talk to you soon, brother.
All right, peace.
All right, peace.